Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Brought to you by Capital One, where you can open a savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Just imagine, five times more savings toward that overdue home addition, maybe even an addition on that addition. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, NA member FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 15th of January, these are our main stories. Reports from the Sudanese capital Khartoum say that government forces have taken control of the intelligence headquarters where security personnel loyal to the former president Omar al-Bashir were staging a revolt. Taiwan's newly re-elected leader has said the island is already independent and there's no need to declare it formally, in comments likely to anger Beijing. And President Trump's impeachment trial could begin as early as next Tuesday, with witnesses to be called by both sides. Also in this podcast,
I take frog eggs and I harvest stem cells from the eggs, and then I do some genetic and molecular trickery to get the cells to produce certain types of tissues.
There's scientists who say they've developed the first living robots. As we record this podcast, there are reports from the Sudanese capital Khartoum that government forces have overrun the intelligence headquarters where mutineering security personnel loyal to the former president Omar al-Bashir were based. Hours earlier, these were the sounds on the streets of the city. The government described it as a mutiny over severance pay. Faisal Mohamed Saleh is a spokesperson for the Sudanese government.
Some of these units rejected the amount of money that had been decided by the official authority in return for their withdrawal. They felt the amount was less than what they deserved.
On Tuesday, tanks and armoured vehicles were on the streets and the international airport was closed. So how significant are these clashes? Our regional Africa editor is Will Ross.
I think it's extremely dangerous, partly because the places where these people are basically carrying out a mutiny are generally quite close to residential areas where their bases are. And if the military were to try and use force to end this mutiny, it could, you know, produce, you know, a lot of problems for civilians living in that area. It's likely to be a very dangerous move to try and do that. So it's a real dilemma for the authorities. And I think, you know, for months we've had fears that, you know, despite the huge numbers of reforms that have taken place since Bashir was toppled, there have always been these fears that some powerful people who had been pushed to the side, people who were close to Bashir when he was in power, they're not happy with the form, so they might try and kind of destabilise the country to stop these changes from taking place. So that's the fear, that this is something much bigger going on, and we're just seeing the beginning of it today.
That was Will Ross. Taiwan's president, Tsai Ing-wen, has told the BBC that the island has no need to declare formal independence because it's already an independent country. Her remark will anger China, which considers Taiwan part of its own territory and puts pressure on other countries to not recognise the island as a state. Last week, Ms. Tsai won a second term in office. Our China correspondent, John Sudworth, began by asking her how she expected Beijing to react to her victory.
They should have a serious thought about the people's expectation as expressed by the election result. And this is a very strong message from the people of Taiwan. That is, they don't like the idea of being threatened all the time. We're a successful democracy. We have pretty decent economy. Yeah, we deserve respect from China.
You spoke after the result about your hope that there could be a return to dialogue. What can you offer Beijing that might, in your view, open that door a little?
I think it's for the Chinese to have this preparedness to face the reality. And that is the key. If they are not prepared to face the reality, whatever we offer won't be satisfying to them.
Why do you think China was such an issue for voters?
Because over the last more than three years, we're seeing that China has been intensifying its threat. And they have also for actions, military exercises, and they have their military vessels or aircraft cruising around the island. And also with the things happening in Hong Kong, people get a real sense that this threat is real and it's getting more and more serious.
Your predecessor, Ma Ying-jeou, was able to preserve Taiwanese democracy whilst building stronger ties with China economically and culturally. At a small price, the continued ambiguity over the status of this island, what's not to like about that approach?
But the situation has changed. The ambiguity can no longer serve the purposes that it was intended to serve. So we're facing a very different situation now.
Without an expression of good faith on your side, and this is what your critics say, that you in a way are inviting China to react in the way that it is.
I have been rather reasonable in terms of managing our relation with China, and we have refrained from doing things that may be considered as provocative to China, despite that there is so much pressure here that we should go further. But in the last more than 3 years, we have been telling China that maintaining status quo remain to be our policy. But I think that is a very friendly gesture to China.
Are you, in principle at least, in favour of the idea of formal Taiwanese independence?
So we don't have a need to declare ourselves an independent state. We are an independent country already, and we call ourselves Republic of China, Taiwan, and we do have government, and we have the military, and we have elections.
The Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen was speaking to John Sudworth. Human Rights Watch has released its World Report 2020, in which it states that the Chinese government is carrying out an intense attack on the global system for defending human rights. The report also states that the Chinese authorities are overseeing the most brutal and pervasive oppression the country has seen in decades. Our global affairs correspondent Naomi Grimley has seen the report.
It's come out with a long list of things that it's worried about. I mean, first and foremost, it's worried about the situation in Xinjiang with at least a million Uyghurs arbitrarily detained in camps for forced political indoctrination. But it's also worried about the use of technology to ensure repression. This includes things like mass intrusions on people's privacy, forced collection of DNA samples. It's this kind of thing combined with the fact that China has the economic clout to mean that businesses do what it says.
And that economic clout means perhaps, Human Rights Watch suggests, that internationally it's not coming under as much pressure as perhaps it might.
That's right. There's quite a lot of criticism in this essay opening the report, arguing that China should be treated as a global pariah because of this long list of human rights abuses. And instead, it says it's been given the red carpet treatment.
Now, this report was supposed to be launched, wasn't it, in Hong Kong. What happened?
This is quite extraordinary because Kenneth Roth, who's the executive director of Human Rights Watch, he was immediately stopped by immigration officials. Now, they at first told him that the decision was made solely in Hong Kong, but it emerged later that Beijing had basically said that they weren't going to let him in. And let me just give you the reasons. They say that the NGO, referring to Human Rights Watch, had supported anti-China radicals, encouraged them in extremist, violent and criminal activity, and incited Hong Kong independent separatist activities. So for that reason, Mr. Roth was turned away, and he's delivered his findings in this report back in America at the UN.
That was Naomi Grimley. In Washington, the impeachment drama is reaching the next phase. The US Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told reporters that the impeachment trial could begin as early as next Tuesday. He also said that both Republicans and Democrats said they wanted to hear from witnesses.
Well, I think we'll be dealing with the witness issue at the appropriate time into the trial. And I think it's certainly appropriate to point out that both sides would want to call witnesses that they wanted to hear from. So when you get to that issue, I can't imagine that only the witnesses that our Democratic colleagues would want to call would be called.
Earlier, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, said it would vote on formally sending the articles of impeachment against Mr. Trump to the Senate on Wednesday. Mr. Trump is accused of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Our correspondent in Washington, Ben Wright, began by explaining what will happen on Wednesday on Capitol Hill.
We've been waiting for this moment since mid-December, and that finally is going to happen. There will be a vote of a congressman that will pass. Then I think there's going to be a ceremony when members of Congress then actually carry the articles of impeachment in a ceremony over to the Senate, hand them over, and that sort of begins the formal process. We could also see the Chief Justice brought over from the Supreme Court, who'll preside over this trial, and we may see the start of senators being sworn in, who of course will act as the jury. So the drama will begin.
Of course, it's highly unlikely, isn't it, that President Trump will be convicted. So what is it that the Democrats hope to get out of this?
Well, that is what we need to remember as all this theatre kicks off. Almost nobody in Washington expects President Trump to be found guilty or removed from office as a result of all of this. The Democrats hope that they will just make life politically very uncomfortable for him for the duration of this trial, remind American voters about the contents of that phone call last July when he was talking to the Ukrainian president about wanting to dig up some dirt on Donald Trump's political rivals, and there was the question of whether military aid would be withheld. And, I mean, the Democrats feel this is strong stuff that should be causing the president political damage, and they want that aired all over again in the Senate. But there are also a number of people in Washington, and many Republicans certainly feel this, who say this is all a waste of time because there is no chance of him being found guilty because the Republicans control the Senate. You need a two-thirds majority for him to be removed from office. So it could all look to many Americans like a bit of a sideshow. And I think that's what many Republicans are hoping.
That was Ben Wright in Washington. A passenger plane has dumped fuel on the playground of an elementary school just before it made an emergency landing at Los Angeles International Airport. The Delta Airlines flight had just taken off when it reported a problem and had to return. Fuel dumps are only allowed over open water. Peter Bowes reports from Los Angeles.
It seems to have been an emergency landing. We know from the Federal Aviation Administration the Delta Airlines flight had taken off from Los Angeles International Airport, declared an emergency, and then returned to the airport and landed safely. Now, this is about the same time that emergency services were called to this school in the city of Cudahy, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. Children and some adults at the school in the playground were reporting skin irritation. Some 70 firefighters and paramedics called to the scene and were treating these people at the scene. No one was taken to hospital. So according to the fire service, they have confirmed, as far as they're concerned, that this was jet fuel. The Federal Aviation Administration says it is aware of the reports and is looking into the circumstances of these children and adults being treated for those skin irritation injuries.
That was Peter Bowes in Los Angeles. The Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro, has said that his government managed to defeat an economic war and several coup attempts organized by the United States last year. In his annual State of the Nation address, Mr. Maduro said US sanctions had failed to bring the country to its knees. Our America's editor, Leonardo Rocha, reports.
Mr. Maduro said the Venezuelan people had stood together in 2019 to defeat an economic war waged by the United States. He accused the opposition leader, Juan Guaido, of acting like Washington's puppet and said the U.S. plan had failed. Mr. Maduro's comments came in a surprise appearance at the Constitutional Assembly in the same building where the opposition-controlled parliament was due to meet. Mr. Guaido cancelled today's session to avoid a confrontation with government forces.
Mr. Guaido says Venezuela is going through an unprecedented humanitarian crisis caused by corruption and incompetence. More than 20,000 people in the Philippines who have fled an erupting volcano have been warned that they might have to stay away from the area for weeks, although some are already returning. In a BBC interview, a Philippine politician, Francis Tolentino, advised those who fled the Taal volcano to remain in evacuation centres. Experts are warning that there could be an explosive eruption at any moment. Howard Johnson sent this report from the city of Tagaytay, close to the volcano.
We've come to visit a local community on the edge of the exclusion zone here who say the volcanic ash has destroyed their livelihoods. Now, looking around, it's grey everywhere. There's ash, thick ash on fallen trees. There's lots of branches on the floor, corrugated iron that's been ripped off roofs. And really, all you can see is the colour grey.
Margie and Noel Vergas own a small plot of land in the vicinity of Taal Volcano. They grow vegetables and breed chickens for a living. But their lives were turned upside down on Sunday when the volcano began erupting.
Around 4 in the afternoon, we panicked. We saw a huge smoke cloud coming from the volcano and we could smell something awful. Ash began falling with small stones and soil. We evacuated because some people said that there would be a tsunami on the lake next to Taal. We became scared.
Noel says he wanted to return to his house today to check on his livestock, but he found that many of his birds were in a sorry state.
So Noel is showing me a fighting cock here. It's a popular sport in the Philippines, and the bird here is covered in dust and ash. He said a lot of the birds were affected when he left his farm to seek safety in a shelter and evacuation centre, and other chickens are in a bad state. I've seen one at the back with what looks like a broken wing. So Noel is showing us his vegetable patch. He grows squash, but he says that the condition of these plants now are so bad that he can't harvest them and that he can't take them to market for sale. You can hear the wind in the trees, and what that's doing is displacing the ash from these palm trees. So right now I'm being covered in droplets of dried up ash. Initially it was quite wet, but now a lot of the ash is in the air and it's getting into people's lungs.
Concerns over the ill effects of breathing ash-laden air has prompted many people in the area to rush out and buy face masks. Local media say some hardware stores are clean out of stock, while other unscrupulous businesses are reportedly stockpiling masks to sell them at higher prices. But for Margie, air quality is the least of her concerns.
We're still anxious because the volcano still spews smoke. Of course, what's happening in our area has hurt us, but we're thankful because our house is still standing.
That was Margie Vegas ending that report from Howard Johnson near the Taal volcano in the Philippines. Now, here is news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
What do our most successful innovators think about the inventions they unleashed upon the world?
1,000 songs in your pocket. No one ever had that experience before.
Do they like the way it turned out?
Do you use GPS?
Oh, absolutely. But it dismays me because people are losing their capacity to read maps.
And are they proud of what it's become?
I looked over at the next table and there was a family and all four of them were sitting there looking at their cell phones. And I thought that was terrible.
In our podcast, World Wise Web, teenagers like me get to question the people who invented the tech we take for granted.
When did you come up with the idea, and what were you doing whenever you thought of it?
That's World Wise Web from the BBC World Service.
Are you kidding me? All this math, science, and code I've been learning can come together to create worlds and characters and tell stories, and that is like absolutely the coolest thing I've ever heard in my whole life.
Search for World Wise Web wherever you get your podcasts.
That is the most thrilling experience that a human being could ever have.
Iran has condemned a decision by Britain, France and Germany to trigger a formal dispute process over Iranian violations of the International Nuclear Accord. The Iranian Foreign Minister, Javad Zarif, described the move as legally baseless and a strategic mistake. The Europeans say they hope the agreement can still be saved. If it can't, they may reimpose sanctions on Iran. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Robbins.
The global nuclear deal agreed with Iran in 2015
was designed to delay substantially its ability to make a nuclear weapon. But the three European signatories, Britain, France and Germany, have now concluded that Iran's increasing non-compliance gives them no choice but to trigger a formal dispute mechanism. Iran blames President Trump, first for pulling out of the deal made under President Obama, and then for steadily increasing sanctions to prevent the country getting any of the promised economic rewards for compliance. Officially, Britain remains committed to the nuclear deal. It hopes the dispute procedure, which can be extended almost indefinitely, will buy time to negotiate a different new agreement, including both Iran and the United States. But no one seems to have much idea how that can be achieved.
That was James Robbins. The son of the American media magnate Rupert Murdoch has accused the family business of denying climate change. James Murdoch said evidence of a link to Australia's bushfire crisis was being ignored. Nick Bryant reports.
Rupert Murdoch continues to wield power in the land of his birth through his dominant stable of newspapers. During the bushfire disaster, Murdoch mastheads have been criticised for employing columnists who reject the science of global warming and commentators who've denied a link between climate change and the ferocious fire season. Now the media magnate's youngest son, James Murdoch, has criticised his father's news outlets in a joint statement with his wife. Catherine and James's views on climate are well established, a spokesperson told the Daily Beast. They are particularly disappointed with the ongoing denial among the news outlets in Australia, given obvious evidence to the contrary.
That was Nick Bryant. Among the many tragic stories being told from the fires is the death of 19-year-old Courtney Partridge McLennan. She died in late November following an asthma attack as the fires burned near her home in New South Wales. Her sister, Cheryl Lee, told Divya Arya what happened.
She went to bed. She said goodnight to my parents and my younger siblings and she went to bed. There was no symptoms.
And how did your parents find out what had happened the next morning?
She was found with her phone torch on, as though she was looking for something, and her Ventolin was on the bed with her. So it was...
Was there any diagnosis by a doctor, any medical report?
Initially, when they found her, the comments were that, oh, it definitely looks like an asthma attack. You know, it looked like it had happened really quickly. She was looking for stuff. Because of her age, she was sent for an autopsy. So the result of that came back. They still have not confirmed it. There's only been a preliminary report released, which still says unconfirmed, but they've spoken to my parents about finding hyperextension of the lungs and that we know that that is asthma. That's what that does to our bodies.
That was Cheryl Lee, whose sister Courtney died following an asthma attack as fires burned near her home in Australia. A young Chinese woman whose story of poverty and deprivation touched the nation has died. Despite rapid economic growth, poverty and inequality are still problems in China. Michael Bristow reports.
Wu Huayan lived on only 30 cents a day while at college in the city of Guiyang in order to save money for her sick brother. Their parents had already died. Last October, she ended up in hospital suffering from malnutrition after surviving largely on a diet of rice and chilies. She weighed just 22 kilograms. China's said it aims to eradicate poverty by the end of this year. Wu Huayan's story underscores the difficulty of that task. Donations for the student poured in, but too late to save her.
That was Michael Bristow. To sport now, and there are going to be many major tournaments this year, and they don't get much bigger than the Olympics in Tokyo in July and August. The organisers are adding several new sports to the competition, including sport climbing, as it will be called. The event will draw in some of the world's best rock climbers and also possibly put the spotlight on one smaller nation, Slovenia, which is hoping for a medal bonanza. Our Balkans correspondent Guy Delorne reports from Ljubljana, a capital better known for its cafe life than its sport.
Slovenia is a nation of climbers. Small wonder when you can see the mountains from most of the country's major cities, including here in the capital, Ljubljana. But they're also pretty good at climbing indoors. And if the rest of the world didn't know that already, they're bound to find out later this year when sport climbing makes its debut at the Tokyo Olympics.
Being at the Olympics is a dream of every athlete, and so was mine.
Janja Garnbret is just 20 years old, but she's already won multiple world championships and world cups. Olympic gold would complete the set.
Climbing became part of the Olympic family. I hear a lot of expectations from other people, but for myself, I don't put any pressure on myself. Young climbers must come and to challenge older competitors, so I think it's really good.
Bravo, Ina!
Janja Garnbret isn't the only Slovenian climber with Olympic medal hopes. There are two other women currently ranked in the top 10 and two men in the top 20. Tomo Česen has been coach to generations of Slovenian climbers.
This is the advantage we have because we are very small. And the national team always train together, always, which is probably not the case in bigger country. I was 7 years national team coach, and I always wanted that we work together as a team.
Very nice, good job, tremendous job, Kurt. I say, Homa!
Of course, Slovenia is not going to have a clear run to the medals, and the attraction of Olympic competition is drawing in stars from the world of outdoor rock climbing. That includes arguably the biggest name of all, the Czech Republic's Adam Ondra, who's regularly rated as the best rock climber in the world.
I think the most important argument is that it is one of the last, let's say, like a natural sport. You don't really need much, and it's within our genetic code, I think, that we just want to climb up.
So it'll be well worth looking up if you're heading to Tokyo or even just watching on TV. After all, as Janja Garnbret puts it, in what other sport can you see someone hanging by two fingers 15 meters off the ground?
That report by Guy Delaunay in Slovenia. Now, it sounds like something out of a science fiction film, but scientists in the United States say they have developed the world's first living robot using stem cells from frog embryos. The robots that they're calling xenobots are less than a millimetre long and have the ability to self-heal. Dr. Douglas Blackiston is the co-author of the study from Tufts University, and he told us how the robots were made.
Our collaborators at the University of Vermont created a computer program that's built off of cells, virtual cells, and it can, through its own software, design organisms for a specific purpose. So you can ask the computer a question, design me a organism that does not exist anywhere in nature that has the following capabilities. It can move, it can maybe pick something up, it can sense something, it can deliver something. And I came up with a way to build those designs out of actual living tissue. So I take frog eggs that are fertilized. These are aquatic frogs that come from Africa. I harvest stem cells from the eggs, and then I do some genetic and molecular trickery to get the cells to produce certain types of tissues that I can then layer and create a 3D representation of what the computer has created.
What is it hoped that these little bots are going to be able to do?
I think the goal here is that there's a lot of tasks that are difficult for actual robots right now. We can make these very small so they can go places that normal robots can't go. Number two, they can heal themselves. So if you injure them, they repair themselves, which a normal robot can't do. And so we're looking at applications like sensing contaminants in water or gathering up plastics in the oceans or delivering drugs to a patient.
And what will they look like, these things?
We can build all sorts of complex 3D body plans. So we can give them small legs for walking around. We can make them very elongated for slithering through tubes, or we can build them sort of in these clam-like structures, which are capable of walking and shuffling about.
So these are living robots. Does this not raise ethical questions about just because you can, should you?
We do have a lot of discussions with ethicists, both in the university and without. And as of right now, these are still very primitive, so it would be the same as some skin sloughing off of a frog or mowing your grass. These do not have neurons. They don't have brains. They're not capable of reproducing. And so we're starting with something very simple to ask these types of questions before we get to a much more complicated or even sort of conscious organism.
So have you seen Terminator?
I have. I've seen them when I was very young.
And that was your inspiration?
No. So certainly what we're looking for is more of the biological version. We're not looking for the hard, scary skeletal robots. Now, also right now, we're starting very small, so we can hopefully avoid the Skynet situation that was predicted in that movie.
Hopefully. Are you reassured? I'm reassured. That was Dr. Douglas Blakiston. And that's it from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.